forget, each Friday till Christmas, there's no charge to park in downtown Chico. This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio. Welcome to the November 29th, 2017 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal rights and veganism every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico or streaming online at kzfr.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Non-Human Radio. I'm Jeannie Trezino. An extra special top of the show thanks to Guillermo Mash of Without a Roof for his help in re-airing our episode on Heifer International and other animal gifting charities last week. And I welcome back co-host Danny Toms. Welcome back to the studio, Danny.
Thanks, Jeannie. Today we are going to talk about the animal activist group Crustacean Liberation, the story of a former McDonald's child spokesperson who became an animal rights activist, and finally, we'll look at black vegan activism and how it differs from white mainstream vegan activism.
Okay, thanks, Danny. The website Latest Vegan News posted a story about a new animal rights group called Crustacean Liberation. The Florida-based group is dedicated to saving one of the most overlooked and abused groups of animals, that is, lobsters, crabs, shrimp, and other crustaceans. The organization, started by Robbie Ruderman of Miami, Florida, is just getting off the ground with Lobster Liberations. The group's goals are to set captured crustaceans free and to raise awareness about the obscenely cruel treatment of these innocent feeling beings. The group buys lobsters and then works as a team to release them into appropriate places in the wild. All rescued crustaceans must be released into their native waters to ensure their well-being and survival. Founder Robbie Ruderman felt that there was a need for an organization to advocate strictly on behalf of crustaceans who endure the most extreme and unnecessary suffering when they are mutilated, dismembered, steamed, and boiled alive, all while fully conscious. The treatment of crustaceans would constitute felony convictions if this were being done to dogs or cats, which is something we say over and over on the show. What we do to non-human animals for food, we would not countenance if these were dogs or cats.
This is definitely something I remember, and probably many people remember from just being a little kid back when you could see the lobster tank in your average supermarket or in the restaurant, and their claws are taped together, and you just kind of like, well, that's interesting. And then you ask, so what's going on there? And then you find out, and it's just like, it's horrible.
Yeah, my folks never brought home one of those things. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness. I don't know what I would have done had that happened. Yeah. Crustaceans have been on this earth for 150 million years, and some scientists believe that their intelligence rivals that of cephalopods, which is to say octopuses and squids. According to Ruderman's research, crustaceans have very good memories and recognize other crustaceans and remember past acquaintances. Crustaceans are also expert navigators with highly developed sensory abilities, which grow over time, right? So they as they linger in an area, they get to know the terrain better and they get to know it very well. They're even known to walk hand in hand or claw in claw with the older lobster leading the younger. Most importantly, of course, these animals are sentient, and they possess the ability to feel emotions, including pain. Ruderman told the Latest Vegan News website that his group, Crustacean Liberation, believes that, quote, all animals have a right to life, a right to live free, and a right to live free from suffering. Unfortunately, our daily food choices have vast and tragic implications for animals and our health. It is well within our grasp to eat a healthy and compassionate diet, and our own lives will be deeply richer for it, end quote. He's a pretty soulful kind of guy. Other countries like Italy and New Zealand have actually made it illegal to boil or cut open a lobster while it's still alive. And Ruderman believes American legislators need to take this issue more seriously.
I mean, Italy of all places.
I know,
shocking.
Right? Like, you know, foodie nexus for Europe, right? While the Crustacean Liberation Team does purchase lobsters and other animals in order to set them free, according to Ruderman, this does not create any demonstrable demand. He says, our strategy is integrated and responsive to specific and identifiable market triggers that would alert us to a potential increase in demand resulting from our liberation efforts way before it ever happens. Crustacean liberation is purposefully constructed, managed, and monitored to be able to quickly shift tactics to neutralize any potential increase in demand by diverting, diversifying, relocating, reducing, or suspending our liberation efforts at any time for any specific crustacean species or for all crustacean species and at any level from local to regional or national.
So I feel like that guy must have come out of a marketing background or something.
Oh, to cover all the bases like that?
Yeah, I think to summarize, what he's saying is they're actually buying lobsters to set them free, and if they are paying attention to see if they drive up the market price, which would be the opposite of what you're trying
exactly.
to do, and if they notice that, they are going to do something else.
Yeah, he has a section on his site talking about, like, well, should we rescue and liberate small lobsters or bigger lobsters?
Right.
And how to kind of maximize your economic capital,
right.
so to speak, right?
Maybe they get to the point where they can pay the fishermen not to do it.
Yeah, maybe. And I think, you know, but basically he says raising awareness is
right.
key above all else.
And, right.
Holding these liberation efforts and sharing widely via social media will help to change the minds of consumers, right?
Right.
He wants people to know that these animals are as worthy and deserving of respect and protection as any other.
I mean basically anything that's not a cute, fuzzy mammal is at a very high disadvantage in terms of cruelty that will happen to it, you know?
Yeah, and maybe your tactics for raising awareness about these animals is different than what the tactics you would use for... other farm animal rescues.
Right.
Right? I mean, and even in the farm animal rescue movement, there's a divide about, do we pay $10 or $5 for that male veal calf in the auction ring?
Right.
Right? It's not a substantial amount of money, but you are feeding into this industry that you are vehemently opposed to.
Definitely.
But I think in terms of lobsters, I mean, there's nobody,
yeah.
there's not many people doing anything prominent to raise awareness about them. So, I don't know. I wish them luck. You can follow Crustacean Liberation on Facebook and on Instagram at, of course, Crustacean Liberation. So, anyway. So you're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. What do you have going up next, Danny?
Have you ever wondered what happens to the smiling children in McDonald's commercials that they use to promote their food? Do they become McDonald's superfans, and do they receive free fast food for the rest of their lives? In a story from the UK-based newspaper The Independent, it turns out that in the case of Ben Williamson, just the opposite happened. Williamson ended up as the senior international media director of the animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, also known as PETA.
No way.
In 1993, when Ben was just a wee lad of 7 years old, McDonald's came to Hampstead, a well-to-do part of North London. McDonald's had fought for years for the approval to open one of their fast food chains there. And in an effort to lure in customers, the fast food brand turned their focus on the children.
Always get the children.
Right. To do this, they held a competition among the local schools. The assignment was for the kids to write 12 words explaining why they liked McDonald's, beginning with the phrase, "I like McDonald's because..." According to Williamson, his entry went as follows. "I like McDonald's because there's a wide variety of food, and my pal Ronald thinks so, too."
Oh, such a genius.
Yes, I mean, he was 7 years old, but he kind of knew how to work in a reference to Ronald McDonald might increase his chances. So, as the winner of the competition with his genius-level entry, Williamson was awarded the privilege of cutting the ribbon in front of his classmates and the press, in addition to being served a Filet-O-Fish sandwich on camera, because even at the age of 7, Williamson was already a pescatarian.
I really should have done more research on this guy, because, like, clearly he wasn't, like, a full-on meat eater.
Right.
You know, at that age. But, anyway.
It is pretty embarrassing there for McDonald's. It also makes you think of... you know how capitalism works and exploits, right? This large, wealthy corporate entity was allowed into schools to hold contests with schools to get free press, free ads, ribbon cutting, yada, yada, yada. And what did he get? He got a fish sandwich, you know? So fast forward 17 years to Williamson studying ethics at college, where he was reading the writings of Plato, John Rawls, and Jeremy Bentham. It was the works by Bentham on the capacity of animals to suffer that especially impacted him and led him to become a vegan, not long after Williamson joined PETA. The Bentham quote that is referred to here goes as follows. The question is not, can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer? Why should the law refuse its protection to any sensitive being? And I think, you know, the law tends to refuse its protection when there's profit to be made for somebody else. But Bentham wrote this in 1789, in his book, An Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation. So sometimes you can see how philosophers are well ahead of us. When asked by a reporter how he feels about his past association with McDonald's, given his dedication to protecting animals, Williamson admits feeling regret, saying that his brush with McDonald's was his first exposure to the seductive powers of major corporations.
Oh, but it makes for a great story.
Definitely. Now, Williamson's PR work for PETA focuses on the importance of changing public perception and education. The good news, it seems like major corporations are catching on to changing public perceptions, with many giant corporations, including Tyson, IKEA, and even McDonald's, coming out with vegan options in the last year. The future is looking bright, according to Ben Williamson, who feels that if one 7-year-old consumer could break his shackles and do a 180-degree turn before the age of 30 and go from being a McDonald's poster child to PETA's senior international media director, other consumers can adapt too. And that means all you consumers out there. So anything else going on with fast food and vegan issues, Jeannie?
Yeah, it was interesting to learn that McDonald's has something called the McVegan in Finland.
Of course.
The McVeggie in Norway and Le Grand Veggie in France, of course. But they have no vegan options here.
Can I be triple wrapped in bacon and deep fried in lard, please?
Yeah, pretty much. And then the big news is that in Britain, Pizza Hut just announced that they're going to be offering a vegan cheese option starting next week at all their branches in Britain, of course. And
that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, we're still waiting to see that kind of action here in the States.
Right.
Thanks, Danny. You're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms.
And I'd like to give Jeannie a props here for sticking in, even with some respiratory distress that she's undergoing.
Oh, doesn't it? I think it just gives my voice a little husky, deep tone.
Oh, yeah. You're far more serious now.
Our big story here, the New York Times reports on veganism in the African-American community in a piece titled Black Vegans Step Out for Their Health and Other Causes, written by Kim Severson. The article is the cover story of the New York Times food section Wednesday, November 29th, 2017. And I just have to say, vegan history is being made once again. That's just awesome. The article starts out talking about black vegan activist AFCO, who got tired of hearing that eating vegan was something only white people did. In 2015, she created a list of 100 black vegans for a website, and it included pioneering figures like Dick Gregory and Coretta Scott King and younger, less famous writers, filmmakers, cooks, and activists. Ms. Coe said in an interview with the New York Times that when you say vegan, a lot of people tend to think only of PETA, which sometimes doesn't reflect the massive landscape of vegan activism.
It does not.
It does not. No, PETA does not reflect all vegans. According to Co, the black vegan movement is one of the most diverse, decolonial, complex, and creative movements out there right now. What does she mean by decolonial?
You're asking me this. I kind of know. But, you know, I mean, in the sense that all Western nations are and Europe is, colonialism shaped them, right? Slavery,
right.
Slave trade, stripping of resources, redistribution of wealth, removing your culture, removing your religion. So, you know, often amongst, you know, minorities and other historically oppressed peoples, they talk about decolonialization to try to both get back to their roots. And it's such an insidious set of shackles, to go back to the last article, that are kind of controlling your life and your paths through the world and your economies and everything. So, and it's not something people are often thinking about, especially, obviously, white folks.
Hey, thanks for decoding that for us all. The article went on to say that vegan cooking and eating are having a renaissance among Black American communities, driven in part by movements like Black Lives Matter, documentaries like What the Health, and a growing cadre of people who connect personal health, animal welfare, and social justice with the fight for racial equality. Athletes like Kyrie Irving of the Boston Celtics and pop stars like the singer Jhené Aiko are bringing a certain pop culture cachet to veganism among the Black community. We always see celebrities going vegan, yep. Right? But typically, the ones that get celebrated are often white, right? And so this is a more well-rounded view of that phenomenon. Cookbook authors and a new breed of vegan soul food restaurants offer culinary heft and dignity. Like many food trends that seem new, Black veganism has historical roots. Eating vegan has long been a practice, especially for followers of religious and spiritual movements like Rastafarianism and the African Hebrew Israelites of Jerusalem, which is, I didn't know this, it's a religious group with Black nationalist underpinnings that rose up in the 1960s, and they still run a chain of vegan restaurants in Atlanta, Tallahassee, and surprisingly, Tel Aviv. Like, who knew, right?
Right, right. And I mean, obviously, Ethiopian food and the most Ethiopian restaurants, they actually know what vegan means. It's on their menu. It goes back to their religious practices.
Right, and then here in Chico, we have Sifo's, the Jamaican right. place that has a whole Ital section of the menu, mm-hmm. which is a vegan section of the menu. It turns out avoiding meat is also a core principle of the Nation of Islam, whose founders believe that pork was at the heart of the slave diet and preached vegetarianism as the most healthful diet for African Americans. And I went and did a little research on this, and it turns out that the Nation of Islam founder, the Prophet Elijah Muhammad, said that eating raw fruit and eating no meat was best for Black people in a book that he wrote in 1967 titled How to Eat to Live. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. Many people who give up eating animal products do it for their health or for animal welfare. And the same is true for the new veganism among African Americans. But there's an added layer of another kind of politics. Then the article goes on to profile Jhené Claiborne, who's a personal chef and cooking teacher, as part of a new generation of vegan cooks who are transforming traditional soul food dishes, digging deeper into West African roots of Southern cooking, and infusing new recipes with tastes of the Caribbean. Her first cookbook, Sweet Potato Soul, is due out in February, and she told the New York Times that, quote, "It's not just about what I want to eat so I can live long and be skinny. For a lot of Black people, it's also the social justice and food access. The food we've been eating for decades and decades has been killing us," end quote.
I mean, that's a great thing to recognize, and I think we talk about sometimes about food access and social justice and food deserts, and where do you find food deserts in highly dense urban places that are predominantly people of color.
Right. Thank goodness. You know, I'm just glad that there's some group that's really raising awareness of this. Bryant Terry, another chef that was featured. Bryant Terry is the chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. Wrote a cookbook called Afro-Vegan, Farm Fresh African, Caribbean, and Southern Flavors Remixed. And that cookbook came out in 2014, and it still makes the top 10 soul food cookbook rankings on Amazon. Bryant Terry is quick to say that even his innovative cooking style pales in comparison to what a new batch of Black vegan cooks are doing. According to Terry, he cooks like someone's grandma compared to them.
I have some of his cookbooks, and yeah, they are kind of intentionally his grandmother's recipes. But
what he's really excited about are some of the younger chefs who are professionally trained and know how to put food together in a new way, like the young chef we mentioned earlier, Jhené Claiborne. Jhené's father was raised vegan, according to Hebrew Israelite beliefs, and still eats that way 90% of the time. She grew up eating everything but red meat and learned to cook soul food at her grandmother's side. Now she dedicates herself to countering the notion that soul food has to include meat and that childhood classics need milk or butter. Health is often not enough of a reason for people to give up meat, she said. The challenges that come with being Black in America can be, meaning that being vegan is a choice or a path bigger than the individual, that it can also have political and spiritual dimensions. I think that's interesting because a lot of the motivation that brings people to veganism is health. It's
right.
often like the first step that a lot
right.
of people take. According to Claiborne, one of the toughest cultural touchstones to let go of is fried chicken, she said. She will have people come to her and say that they can't do without the chicken and that they'd rather die a painful death than have to give up chicken. This is how tightly our childhood foods hang on to us, right?
Yeah. I think all of us vegans have had that first, you know, we just had Thanksgiving, right? And you're just like, no, I'm not going to have this dead bird that's kind of on the table all in pieces and gross. And it's just, what do you mean? We always do this.
Right.
You don't love us anymore. No matter what your culture, you know, rejecting your family's food is tough.
Anyway, to help with this issue, Janae created a spicy chicken fried cauliflower in which she builds a crunchy crust by dipping large florets to heavily seasoned flour and then a wet batter of hot sauce. Carry on, Danny.
Dijon mustard and soy milk. So I've had various cauliflower things and it's pretty tasty fried up. And, you know, you think about fried chicken and Colonel Sanders magical seasonings, and it's like it's all about the frying and the seasoning and the spices. It's not really about, you know, what the protein is inside of it. So it's great that she can provide something that people want to satisfy that desire without killing the animal. The New York Times article goes on to say that popular culture is also shining a new light on black veganism and bringing in more converts. Some trace the boost to the late 2000s when two key books were published. Amy Bree's Harper's anthology titled Sista Vegan, Black Female Vegans Speak on Food, Identity, Health, and Society, and Tracy McQuirt's By Any Greens Necessary, a Revolutionary Guide for Black Women Who Want to Eat Great, Get Healthy, Lose Weight, and Look Fat. And just, you know, consider those titles there and what we kind of said before is like the kind of the white vegans often originally were just like, I want to be healthy, I want to live forever, and like
I want to be skinny.
I want to be skinny, I want to achieve some materialistic goal. And like some of these you know, strong feminists here too, initial authors are really tying that all together, which tying, you know, food and culture and identity together, which I think is important, especially if you're trying to like change a particular a group of people.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to Breeze Harper, who got her PhD at UC Davis. She's a Northern California influence for a lot of this black activism, basically, and forcing the vegan community, not forcing, but asking the vegan community.
Holding them accountable.
Yeah, to face up to, you know, more being more inclusionary and not just saying that the only reasons to go vegan are health, environment, and
right.
animal rights, but that there's this other dimension of how animals are looked at and how that often... As how the dominant culture looks at animals.
Right.
Can often be reflected also in the way the dominant culture, the white culture, looks at people of color.
So, right.
After those books, there came Oprah Winfrey, who challenged her staff to go vegan for a week in 2011 and built a show around it. And in 2015, Jay-Z and Beyonce became partners in a vegan meal kit service. And I don't think any of those three individuals stayed vegan. But they certainly brought vegan awareness to the world,
right.
as well as to the black community. Other celebrities continue to join in. Laverne Cox and Daniel Brooks, who are stars of Orange is the New Black, said recently that they were going vegan. And in the current season of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, a cast member, Portia Williams, announced that she was a baby vegan.
Jeannie watches all The Real Housewives of Atlanta.
Yeah, I'm a little behind, though. You know, this cold got me down.
Okay.
I have a lot queued up. And African-American sports stars have embraced vegan diets as a way to improve their performance. Serena and Venus Williams said that they try to eat vegan most of the time. The former NFL linebacker David Carter, who's nicknamed the 300-pound vegan, and we've talked about him on the show before, stopped eating animal products a few years ago in response to injuries and feeling better afterwards.
It also seems to be making quite a few inroads in NBA right now. There's every couple days you hear about another NBA player going vegan or trying going vegan or, you know, factoring it in. You know, and there's often controversy and, you know, amongst vegan activists about celebrity vegans, people that are say they're vegan, but they really mean they're eating vegan sometimes. I think you can, you know, do the movement harm by focusing too much on that and just the preponderance of press and consciousness raising that's going on right now is pretty incredible. And that's what leads to change.
Yep. The final black vegan featured in the New York Times article is Tassili Ma'at, who's the owner of the restaurant Tassili's Raw Reality in the historic West End of Atlanta. She raised her youngest two children as vegans and now eats only raw food. She's a member of the Atlanta chapter of Hip Hop is Green, which she says is a way to help young people identify veganism as both something cool and something political. And of course, sometimes it's just about eating something delicious and having fun. To that end, cooks in several cities, especially in Baltimore, have been begun hosting black-focused vegan food festivals and MacDowns, where hundreds of people compete in vegan mac and cheese competitions. And I know Oakland has had basically a black veg fest.
Yeah.
So this is all good. This is all good.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would like to point out, as someone who is as white as, say, dirty sand, and Jeannie's Asian American, we'd love to hear from any local, black vegans or people of color for any of their thoughts on this, because we're certainly not the authorities on it.
I do not claim to be an authority, but yes, I definitely would love some input. And if our listeners are interested in tracking any of this, if you're on social media or Instagram or Twitter, one thing to follow is hashtag Black Vegans Rock. And that was started by AFCO and has gained a lot of traction. So this is Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio.
And now it's time for the Chico Animal Rights Calendar of Events. Get out your pens. Find your calendars.
At this time of year, where the calendar is pretty sparse, so we just have two items. Tomorrow night is the November meeting of Plant-Based Chico from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Chico Guildhall. At 2775 Nord Avenue. That event is free and open to the public, and they will feature Jacob Carr, who is a Paradise native and a Waldorf teacher at the Blue Oak School here in Chico, who had gastric bypass surgery in 2006 and has been mostly Whole Foods plant-based vegan for about a year, and he has lost over 200 pounds, and he'll be talking about his story. And that is it. I'm going to cut the calendar short because I want to get to the quote of the week.
The animal rights quote of the week is from Tassili Ma'at, Atlanta-based vegan restaurant owner and black vegan activist, who said, "I acknowledge my customers for being modern-day revolutionaries without picking up a gun or having to throw a grenade or pick up a picket sign and carry it down the street. We are defying the death industry."
Rock on. Black vegans rock.
Non-Human Radio is made possible through the generous contributions of KZFR listeners like you. Thanks to Guillermo Mash and Sue Hildebrand for their engineering assistance and moral support. Stay tuned for Sue's show, The Real Issue, coming up next. Her show will be covering this time of reckoning around issues of sexual harassment. You may have seen the news today.
This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, or its staff. Our theme music is Ready to Fall by vegan activist Rockers Rise Against.
This is Danny Toms and Jeannie Trezino signing off. Until next week, be different, be better, be kind, and go vegan.